The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 58. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've got a ton of respect for. He was nice enough to have me on his show the other night, so I'd love to return the favor. I've got so many questions for him. He is a constitutional lawyer, and he's from where I call home when I'm in the United States. That's Las Vegas. Robert Barnes, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Glad to be here.
All right. So for my viewers who might not know your backstory, can you fill them in on that?
Sure. So I used to do political consulting. Then I shifted into law, became a trial lawyer doing a lot of tax cases and criminal tax cases. That transitioned into complex civil cases and constitutional law cases. So ultimately, ended up doing that kind of work. And then I have a side hobby of betting on elections when the opportunity presents itself.
Yeah, I heard that on the Rubin interview. Can you expand on that just briefly? That was really interesting. I never heard of that.
Sure. So I've always been a sports bettor and I've been betting. I used to get my pizza money when I was a kid, betting people on March Madness, that kind of thing. So it sort of got into the bloodstream. It's why I live in Vegas, though now sports betting is spreading across the globe and across the states, of course. But the political betting has always been fun. It's sort of been a hobby to sort of do political analysis and how all of that works. And in that context, political betting became sort of easier legal to do in 2000 and 2004. But you had to, back then, there was something called InTrade. You could do it through an Irish company from the States. They didn't get clear permission from the States to continue to function after 2012. But the betting markets like Betfair, which is like a real trading market. So right. You're like betting a stock. You can go in and out on any given day, any given time, opened up. In the UK, that created a lot of liquidity in the betting markets. So went over there in 2016. Actually, I also bet in 2017, 2018, 2019. Just elections where I think I have a little bit better information than the people setting the odds in the political betting markets.
That's really interesting. I go into, through my videos, I talk about investing all the time in macro. And one of the things I always hit on is the importance of understanding blackjack as your average investor. And in sports betting, exact same thing. It's all about the probabilities. I want to get into the freedom of speech stuff so badly, but could you expand on that just quickly? Try to tell the viewers, not just with betting or with blackjack, but then taking that into the investment world, why it's so important to come at it from that mindset.
Absolutely. I mean, one, it sort of goes to Taleb's theory of skin in the game. So it's like sports betting disciplines you, political betting disciplines you, certain aspects of the law, trial law can discipline you, because when your ability to predict accurately shapes your ability to make money, then you're going to be much more disciplined about how you go about that process. And so it just improves your analytical skill set. It improves your capacity to predict things in a wider range of context. It improves your sort of empirical analysis and causation analysis, which definitely the Western world could use right about now, which appears to be missing in many contexts. So it's very practical, and it is all about probabilities. You're not trying to be 100% right. You're trying to, like in a sports betting context, you're trying to be 55% right, because you can make a nice 10% profit just doing that. Political betting context, the same. It's just being more accurate than the bookie is, being more accurate than the market is, finding where you have an edge, finding where you had an advantage. And years before, I used to play around in the market, but then I realized I had a bigger edge in the political betting and sports betting right. world than I did in the financial market world. But it's the same sort of analysis. It just requires disciplined analysis, understanding probabilities are not certainties, having contingency plans available, not putting all of your eggs in one basket, though I sort of did that in the case of Trump's reelection, first election. But it was worth it because it paid off. It was worth the gamble. Know the gamble that you're taking and you're making.
Yeah. Okay. I could go a million different directions with that, but let's go back to the freedom of speech, the constitutional law. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you represented Alex Jones when he got deplatformed from Twitter. Can you first kind of go over that case? And then I'm going to ask you a ton of questions regarding that.
So they really sort of try to use Alex Jones as a template to deplatform and deny access to the public square, which is increasingly a digital public square, to anybody down the road. We're seeing a version of it now in what words you can and can't say related to something that might be called an infection or virus in the United States in certain places. Your video can get demonetized if certain words are used. Their test case was going to be Alex Jones. So they started with a lawfare. Alex Jones with Infowars.com, been a talk radio host for about a quarter of a century, comes at things from an outsider, independent perspective, mostly apolitical prior to 2016. He was politically engaged, but not on any partisan side of the aisle. He backed Trump. Trump came on his TV show and vouched for him. So there was sort of a reciprocal relationship. He boosted Trump critically in a lot of early primaries and then ultimately in the general election because he's got a very strong base amongst independent voters.
Right.
And so even though he comes from the political right, he overlaps in unique ways. So like he's probably the most important anti-war voice on the right, anti-surveillance state voice on the right, anti-Fed voice on the right. He's not a conventional sort of Fox News perspective.
For sure. And
he's given a platform to all kinds of independent voices all across the globe. So, you know, whether you're talking about someone like William Binney, who was one of the first big NSA whistleblowers, or you're talking about Peter Schiff on the economic side of the equation, or you're talking about people the Snowden discoveries or Julian Assange, one of the first places they got broad platform in the United States was on Alex Jones's Infowars.com show. Mm-hmm. But because he was seen by the left and some Democratic partisans as helping Trump, he became a target. So in the first 25 years of his legal career, he's never had any issue with any platform. I mean, his not legal career, but his in terms of the legal world, for the first 25 years of his career, he has almost no lawsuits at all. No lawsuits in federal court, state court, none of his platforms. He isn't getting deplatforming. He's not facing any consequences at all from the legal arena in terms of their dislike of his political viewpoints. That all changes after Trump gets elected. Towards the end of the Trump campaign, Hillary Clinton makes him a name target throughout part of her speeches, beginning in a speech, interestingly enough, started in Las Vegas. She makes the first speech where she name drops Alex Jones. By October of 2017, a guy who had not been sued in 25 years in any meaningful way will face within a year over a dozen federal lawsuits and over a dozen state lawsuits. They just start, and they then use the lawsuits, and they come at him from every possible angle. They're suing him on copyright theories. They're suing him on defamation and libel theories. They're suing him on any kind of speech someone even associated with him made. And then they use those suits to go to Twitter, to go to YouTube, to go to Google, to get him completely deplatformed overnight. So overnight, he loses all of his YouTube videos, even though YouTube had given him awards. He was one of the first million subscriber guys on YouTube. He helped boost YouTube substantially, give YouTube a lot of profit. And then all of a sudden, overnight, without any notice at all, he loses all access to his YouTube channels and is banned from YouTube altogether. And anyone associated with him is banned from YouTube. That's part of his InfoWars brand. Then on top of that, then Twitter within a day or two also deplatforms. Then Google changes its algorithm so that if you search his name, you get almost all negative articles and stories. What I always tell people is you want to see a live experiment of what deplatforming looks like in the modern world, go to Google and search Alex Jones, then go to DuckDuckGo or Bing and search Alex Jones, and you'll see radically different results. It's the most the glaring disparity of outcomes. And so in that context, I've done a lot of First Amendment representation. A lot of the tax cases I did had a First Amendment context to it. Back in the day, I represented Peter Schiff's dad briefly, Irwin, a very interesting
hero of mine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, really independent guy, Las Vegas-based guy. I wanted him to sell his book on the courthouse steps because they were prohibiting him from public. And I said, you know, let's put the First Amendment issues up front and center. Then he got sidetracked with other cases that of course took him out for a while. But those cases really always had a speech context to them. People were being attacked, not really because of their behavior. They were being attacked because the government didn't like their speech, didn't like their ideas, didn't like what the ideas they were trying to communicate and spread to other people. And so it was a natural First Amendment overlap, and I'd already done other First Amendment cases for people like Ralph Nader. I'd represented people like Wesley Snipes in other contexts outside of tax involving government abuse of power. I'd been doing civil rights cases.
I want to make sure people understand that it's not that you're just this guy on the right that's, you know, gung-ho conservative in Fox News, so you want to pick this up because it's kind of within the narrative that you have in your own mind. You've represented people on the right and people way on the left. The one thing that connects everybody is the freedom of speech.
Exactly. The utility I had is that when people started to come at me and for being connected to Trump or supporting Alex Jones, is that I represented literally everybody across the political spectrum. Every year I take pro bono cases across the country, including across the globe. I've taken asylum cases. I've taken cases for people who are, whether you call them like undocumented or call them illegal immigrants, people that are here in that context where their rights are also being violated. So I'll represent anyone whose constitutional rights are being violated, regardless of political flavor. So I've represented the Peace and Freedom Party, the last true socialist party in the United States. Represented Jill Stein in 2016, represented the Green Party many times over the years, represented Ralph Nader in multiple contexts, represented Wesley Snipes, whose politics is very independent, but is more on the left. Mm-hmm. Has done a lot of work in that field for African-American history, and also he has Native American roots. And then also represented the Libertarian Party, Tea Party, Taxpayers Party, Alex Jones, people on the right. The Covington kids, I guess people would put them on the right, though I see that as a non-partisan issue. I just see it as the media getting out of control.
For sure. So
represented people all across the political spectrum. I've sued the various cities and counties and state governments on your everyday civil rights cases, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Eighth Amendment cases that involve excessive bail imposition, cases that involve wrongful imprisonment, cases that involve people wrongfully treated that were either in mental health facilities or in jails. So I've been, and politically, up until 2016, most of my friends would have seen me more on the independent left. Because I came from a sort of old Southern Democratic populist tradition, guys like Huey Long and Big Jim Folsom and those kind of folks. And so I, even though I had a deep skepticism of how our financial system operated, it's a place where sort of the left and the right kind of tend to meet in doubting the institutional state and NSA-driven industrial complex, financial complex kind of world that doesn't really work for ordinary people. But Trump, sort of like Alex Jones, I started shifting to the right politically because increasingly the left was becoming statist in orientation. It was no longer about individual rights or individual liberties or individual protection. The people I had to fight the most in the Nader cases and in the Peace and Freedom Party cases was the institutional Democratic Party operatives in those respective states. So it was people like I'd got a scholarship to Yale when I was a kid. And I went up there thinking it was going to be all these really smart kids. And when I get up there, I find out it's mostly a lot of rich kids. I used to steal from Jesse Jackson's quote, which is the Ivy League isn't the best and the brightest. It's the richest and the whitest. But there was some truth to that when I got up there. They're a professional class population that really thinks they should run the world for the rest of us, whether it's medicine, whether it's in law, whether it's in economics, whether it's in government. And they lack the diverse life experience that's necessary to be good at it. They lack the independent, dissident sense of perspective that's necessary to make sure that the best ideas are heard, debated, and filtered out in the process. They're really the worst people we could possibly have running the world are the people largely running large parts of the world.
Yeah, it goes back to what Milton Friedman always used to say about that. But okay, so going back to the Alex Jones, what was Twitter's stance? Like, what was their position? And then what was Alex's position? Just for the, if we bring it down to like a third grade level for me, and then maybe a seventh grade level for my viewers. I'm way down on the totem pole here.
Yeah, so they offered different excuses at different times. So what really became clear was they were going to suppress Alex's voice just because he was Alex Jones, and using in mostly the excuse of the lawsuits that were pending against him. But they used other triggering factors. So in the case of Twitter, they said, well, he put up this meme that looks like he's beating someone up, when it clearly had nothing to do with that. And this ended up being debated on with Tim Pool on Joe Rogan's podcast with Jack Dorsey and his counsel.
Right.
And you could tell that Twitter's counsel only knew the official pretextual reason. She didn't know the actual underlying reason. So they basically just said, look, we can suspend anyone anytime we want because we're a private company. And even if it, and we don't have to conform, and that our terms of service permit us to do anything we want, anytime we want, for any reason we want. And that was their ultimate legal excuse. Their political excuse was, look at these lawsuits that are pending, and look at some of these things that we don't like. We think he did something wrong in this particular instance or that particular instance. They end up backing away from those particular instances because when people looked at them, they said, how did you misconstrue a sort of satirical video as actually portraying physical violence? Well, you actually do have terrorist groups on Twitter promoting various forms of violence that they don't suspend. So they backed away from that in the court of public opinion, as I say, and they just instead fell back on legally we can do what we want, and he's getting sued a lot. And they wanted to see what would happen. What would be the public relations reaction? What would be the governmental politicians' reaction? And because Jones is a very much sort of an anti-establishment political figure, nobody within the establishment came to rally for him. And I was one of the first people to do so because I said, they're not going to stop here. Sometime we're going to have some sort of either an actual war or the buildup of a war or a crisis like we have right now in the pandemic. And they're going to use this as a pretext to shut down any sites they don't like, any videos they don't like, any independent dissident information they don't like. And they're going to become what Eric Weinstein and Peter Thiel call the gatekeeper institutional narrative, where they are the gatekeepers controlling who has access to them. It was also a slope. Absolutely. And it was part of a backdrop. The backdrop of big media was putting pressure on big tech. And that's why you saw these hit pieces in the New York Times against YouTube and things like that, because they feared that big tech would replace them. It was sort of loosely portrayed behind the scenes in shows like Succession on HBO, that sort of a fictionalized version of Fox. And the fear within the institutional media was that basically Google and YouTube and Twitter could completely supplant them for control, being the gatekeepers to what is the appropriate informational institutional narrative. And essentially what has happened is they've all now gone along, Google, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, with the big media to continue their role as a gatekeeper institutional narrative. That backed off people like George Soros, who was trying to short Facebook and was going after them in a very high profile public way. And that backed off people in the political classes on the Democratic side, giving him pressure, the Democrats calling for hearings and things like that. Backed off Elizabeth Warren, quit talking about disbanding and breaking them up. And even further, it backed off the New York Times writing hit pieces about him. And so now if we all go to YouTube, even though I've never subscribed to any big institutional narrative, because I don't go to YouTube to get what the New York Times or CBS thinks. I can get that on my own. It's bombarded to me all the time anyway. Now that's what I get. When my recommended video list is all CNN, NBC, ABC, the New York Times, Washington Post, whatever the institutional establishment narrative is, that's now being pushed so that they've been able to remonopolize their gatekeeper role. And that's what Jones was sort of all about. It was removing Jones as a independent challenge to the gatekeeper control of the institutional narrative, and showing that by privatizing the public square, they could effectively, in the digital space and by digitizing it, they could now have more control than the First Amendment would ever allow any government to do.
Okay, so I want to unpack that before we get into more specifics on Jones's side.
Sure.
I want to look at Twitter because there's so many things, so many variables. I don't know, and I'd love to get your insider opinion on this. Is Twitter coming at this just politically motivated? Meaning Jack is like, okay, I'm hardcore on the left, so I want to run my business that way. Or is he looking at this saying, okay, I've got all these employees that are very hard to come by in San Francisco or in Silicon Valley, and if I don't make a stand on the left, they're going to quit, then I'm screwed, and I've got my responsibility to my shareholders. Or is he saying, I've got the responsibility to the shareholders, we're not making a profit right now, and I cannot afford to get into a battle with the New York Times or any of these people that want to take me down? Or is it something that the CEO of a high profile company says, you know what, if I'm going to have to pick a side here in my public life, I would rather be on the side of the left, because I know that if I do get high profile enough, that's the side that's most likely to come after me in the form of higher taxes, maybe not getting tax breaks, where if I come out, let's say, of the closet on the right-hand side, well, I'm much more likely to be attacked by that group of politicians, where the politicians on the right, I'm not saying they're good by any means. I dislike both parties equally, but at least the ones, if you're a business CEO, the politicians on the right are less likely to come after you, or is it a mix of everything? What do you think from the insider perspective?
So I was one of the first people to sue Twitter, because I sued them in California on behalf of Charles Johnson, where all four of those factors that you're talking about were present, plus a fifth. So the fifth factor is, I call it sort of the popular front strategy of the communist in the 19-teens and 1920s, which was infiltrate the institutions that have the most influence over the public mind. And their goal was to infiltrate the State Department in the United States, to infiltrate advertising departments and marketing departments in the United States, and human relations and employment departments in the United States, as well as universities and teaching academies. And the thought process is if you get into where the mind is actually shaped and thought is actually shaped, then you can, I mean, that's where, like, a lot of the McCarthyism, well, clearly it was excessive, all the blacklists that took place, they weren't entirely without some factual predicate. There was an attempt to infiltrate Hollywood. There was an attempt to infiltrate the State Department. There were attempts to infiltrate big corporations. That actually did happen. They just went to target anyone they disliked politically for independent reasons. That's what happens. Well, like what we're seeing right now, it's what happens when you give politicians a blank check. They write that check for as much as they can cash it. And so in Twitter's context, he originally started out, and I think Dorsey was sincere initially, though I've talked to people who know about some of the interior technology that they built up, and they have more skepticism of them, kind of like, well, a lot of the criticism I used to get when I was working in the tech industry in the early 90s, the people who really did not like Bill Gates. So you get some of that feedback. But putting that aside, his pitch was he was going to be the free speech wing of the free speech party, that he was going to be the most free speech place. And there's some people that think he really meant it, and then things changed his mind. Others think, well, that was just a marketing technique, because Twitter, there's a tendency, as Peter Thiel has talked about, that the nature of technology in this space creates natural monopolies, and that once you sort of dominate, nobody can really compete with you. And so Twitter's goal was to make sure they got an edge over their competitors early. And what they knew, interestingly enough, early on was that it was the independent left, but particularly the independent right, which had the biggest demand for its services, because these were people who were being systematically shut out of the mainstream establishment. They were left outside the gate of the gatekeeper institutional narrative. So for that reason, he was even more aggressive at pushing free speech wing of the free speech party. He has people like Alex Jones, helps build up his platform. Charles Johnson became one of the first Twitter trolls, but it helped build his platform, bring attention to Twitter. And he was able to develop a market edge and a market advantage. And so there was a sort of economic logic for his product to be on the political right, or to at least be a free speech wing of the free speech party. The other thing, though, that happened along the way is that the professional class millennial left was much better at using these new social mediums in political campaigns than the right was. The independent right was good at developing it sort of under the surface, but not as part of the professional political campaigns. Obama really weaponized Twitter and Facebook and YouTube much better than anyone ever had before. And so there became this assumption amongst, as the sort of all of Silicon Valley started to politicize, and this sort of, there's a good book out there called The Big Short by a guy who was writing about this after the 2004 election, talking about how people are becoming politicized to the point that they decide what the political nature of their neighbors look like before they move in. You know, he's like people are making real estate decisions based on the political affinities of people in that area. People are making grocery store decisions based on the perceived political affinity of things. So that started in 2004, deeply entrenched in the millennial generation, but they hadn't yet started to dominate the professional class that they really do in large part today. So you have this new politicization that's taking place. They're starting to rise in power in Silicon Valley, but they don't either see the threat from the sort of the independent people who they disagree with being able to use their social media platforms to achieve success, because the first guy to achieve success is Obama with it. You compare Obama to Romney, it's not even close in terms of social media dominance. They did not see Trump coming.
Yeah, they were to see that go. Hey, maybe it's not a good idea.
Exactly. As soon as they saw Trump, especially when they saw Trump win, they'd convinced themselves throughout 2016 they didn't need to censor at all. Jack, to his credit, was pushing back. Jack Dorsey at Twitter was pushing back on calls for censorship. And they thought everything was going to be fine until, and they even held a conference. They always hold, you know, whether it's the Fed or anyone else, they always have to hold conferences in some little island off the coast of South Carolina. But they even held a conference in the spring in 2016, where Zuckerberg was there, people from YouTube were there, people from Google were there, people from Twitter were there, talking about whether they were going to leverage their influence on the election, because I was following it for my political betting purposes. I didn't even have a rooting interest in it at that point, as to what happened. And they decided not to do anything because everybody was convinced that there was no way Trump could win. And once he won, that changed the script entirely. And all of a sudden, what someone like Dorsey faces, he faces internal pressure from his engineers and his marketers and his lawyers, all of whom hate Trump, all of whom now blame their own social media network brand and access tool for Trump's election. And then people affiliated with and associated with Trump, such as people like Alex Jones. So he's got a problem with all of his professional class that advises him. He's got a problem with all of his key employees that work for him. He's got a problem. And then he gets that's problem category one. Problem category two becomes the political class. The politicians on the Democratic side start waging war, start demanding subpoenas, start intruding upon what all of these organizations are doing. And it's always a perjury trap. There's no way to answer all those questions perfectly. Ask Roger Stone what can happen to you if they just decide to prosecute you. So they're creating personal criminal exposure for the heads of Google and YouTube and Facebook. Third, Soros starts waging wholesale war on him. So Soros starts publicly attacking him, dumps a lot of his stock in him, lets everybody know he's dumping a lot of his stock in him, saying that they have problems. He's basically waging the kind of war you would see a short wage against a company to make the short payoff. So much so that Zuckerberg was doing massive investigations on Soros. I mean, they were ready. Zuckerberg was the one pushing back the most against this while experimenting with being president himself, doing his little tour and all that jazz.
Right.
And then fourth, you're getting pressure from stockholders, from shareholders who have the same political preferences, because they don't like Trump, and they see what's happening in the political arena, and they see what's happening with people like Soros, and they see what's happening with the legal and professional class saying it's bad. And then to add to all of that, you get the New York Times and the institutional media and 60 Minutes start to run hit pieces. Say YouTube promotes Stefan Molyneux and people who really weren't that controversial a month ago, all of a sudden they're portraying them as all right, as neo-Nazis, and using all the inflammatory rhetoric and language. So all of a sudden they're under massive pressure from everywhere. And then there's sort of AstroTurf campaigns. People start filing all kinds of complaints within the consumer complaint processes that Twitter has, that YouTube has. So all of a sudden, if there's a potential copyright argument, somebody's going through every, say, Alex Jones video, every Stefan Molyneux, and saying, oh, hey, we can do a copyright strike here. They were doing it to Joe Rogan. They were doing it to, you know, every little musical thing that was played, any little photo that was used, any video that was done. You have people like Sargon of Arkad, ends up getting not only sued, but attacked and has his video removed for what was an actual frivolous lawsuit, as the court ultimately determined. But, you know, he was out of the game before, at least on YouTube, before he could make meaningful remedy. So that he is facing pressure from everywhere. And the only pushback is from a few conservative politicians who are inconsistent in their approach and are naturally like Dave Rubin. They're kind of they have contradictory impulses here. They don't want to see big tech use their control and monopoly over the social media space to suppress independent views, but they don't want the government to replace big tech in that role of securing the presence of independent views.
Right.
So the right is politically disadvantaged in being able to contest or challenge this because their own ideological limitations don't provide an easy resolution. And the only risk is lawsuits. I start bringing those lawsuits, but the courts as a whole have interpreted various congressional immunity provisions to mean protect big tech economically. So they don't allow, so even though really what big tech is doing, in my view, runs afoul of First Amendment principles and other principles, Congress's Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which was intended to help big tech, help the United States in particular, develop a big tech edge against Asia and the rest and the original development of big tech ideas like Google, like YouTube, like Twitter, like Facebook, has been interpreted to mean they should never be sued for anything that happens on their platforms. That's how courts have interpreted that. Even that's not what the law says, it's how they've interpreted it. So even Republican courts, who already are disinclined to have the state get involved in this matter at all, whether it be through the courts or the executive branch or the legislative branch, are doubly unwilling to get involved and to intervene. And so it ends up with ordinary people having no meaningful remedy beyond political activity until the legislature changes the laws to allow these suits to go forward. Even though on paper, the First Amendment does preclude monopolies of the public square from censoring speech, going back to the company towns, going back to private malls in California. Those laws, unfortunately, are not being enforced in any court in America today.
Yeah, okay. So I want to kind of frame this, and then you can tell me where I'm wrong, and we can kind of get more into the nitty-gritty. So for me, as just a libertarian, you know, I retired in 2012 as an entrepreneur since I got out of college. So I see that side of it. I also see the side of it of free speech that, listen, I'm almost an absolutist. I think there's an argument for allowing people to go into a movie theater and yell fire. Or when you look at all the downside of the slippery slope where that takes us, which this is a great example. But just taking it down to its simple form. So it's a business, a private company, in my mind, private property. Therefore, they should have the ability to do anything they want as long as it's not illegal. And then on the other side, though, I think you should be able to say quite literally anything you want. So how do I reconcile that? Tell me where I'm wrong there on the either the side of you should be able to say anything you want or on the side of this is a private company, therefore they should be able to do anything they want on their platform or whatever they physically own.
So my view on that is twofold on the private company side. One is what's unique in this context is that each of these private companies developed a market advantage because they made specific promises to the public to induce their participation. And those promises were, particularly in the case of Jack Dorsey, but variations of this happened with YouTube and Facebook and Google as well, which is we're going to be the free speech wing of the free speech party. So don't look at any of our competitors that might be out there. Come and join Twitter. Help monetize this brand by you joining us. Help give us a practical monopoly over this particular social media platform. And in exchange, we'll protect your free speech. So to me, on equitable principles, on contractual principles, they're different than a private company. All of us as private companies have to be held responsible for our promises. And that they should not be exempt from that just because their breaking their promise now serves the interest of certain political classes in America. So I think that's what removes them. In other words, I'm not asking them to be treated any differently than a private company. I'm saying just that they should not be treated any differently than any private company.
So they kind of misrepresented their product or service. Like Ford saying, okay, go online and select your car, and you select a blue truck, they deliver a red sedan. And then they say, okay, well, you just got to be happy with whatever we gave you.
Exactly, because heck, we're a private company and it's still a car.
Right.
So, and that's part one of it. The second part of it is in the United States, there's always been a provision that if you achieve monopoly power over the public square, those are the two components. You have de facto monopoly power, which is usually evaluated at more than 75% market share of right. that particular area. And it's the public square that you have the monopoly over. So this used to be a big problem with company towns. So company towns figured out, well, how do we suppress union activity? Well, we got to keep them from organizing and petitioning. Well, how do we do that? Well, we just own the whole town. And if we own the whole town, we can have our sheriff ban any sort of getting together of anything. And it was a case that arose in a different context, but it was comparable. Went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, that private businesses have an absolute right to do whatever they want, but when they choose to have monopoly power, because you don't, I mean, you can always forfeit some degree of monopoly power, or when they choose, and when they choose to have that monopoly power over the public square, such that the only place the public square can be in that particular town is where they have a monopoly, then in that context, we're gonna say you're gonna have to, as a consequence of that monopoly over a public square, you have to protect free speech and First Amendment rights because that's the United States.
Got it.
So I've always thought that was a good constitutional doctrine. Should be that it's perfectly analogous and applicable to the digitization of the public square that we have today, and that they and all of these and that's why I separated. Like people are like, aren't you worried by this various legal theories of holding big platforms responsible, that the little platform is all of a sudden going to be held responsible? And I'm like, I agree that the small company that has their own web page or their own social domain or their own, they should not be, or their own message board, they should be allowed to censor whatever they want. But they are not in a monopoly power over the public square. It's that if you choose to have monopoly over the public square, then that's when there's a price to pay for that, a public yeah. price for that public monopoly. Now, the ultimate solution that I've been recommending, and when I talked to Senator Hawley from Missouri and other people, he ended up making his bill much more complicated, unfortunately. God bless politicians.
Yeah, I was going to say, leave it to a politician, buddy.
Two paragraphs. I was like, just make it simple. Take Section 230 immunity and keep it there and say you get to stay immune from all the things that publishers could be sued for. Because right now, even though they're a private company, they are uniquely immune in state and federal court from being sued for what happens in their publishing decisions.
Because they're seen as a platform.
Exactly. Sorry, right? Because as long as, and now that they're overtly saying, you know what, we're not a platform, we're a publisher. Right. We're deciding what gets said on that platform. We're not just providing the wood to stand on for anyone to speak. We're going to decide who can speak on that platform. Then they're asserting publisher privileges, but they don't have publisher responsibilities because of Section 230. And my solution to this wasn't necessarily to remove their publisher privileges. It was instead to say, let's just extend the First Amendment. Say you can stay immune from suit. Even though you're acting like a publisher, you won't be sued as a publisher because we like all the speech that flourishes from you being allowed to be a publisher. But the precondition is you have to comply with the First Amendment. And as long as you comply with the First Amendment, you get to keep your immunity. And the advantage with that is that's not any intrusion on private space or private economy. It's just giving people a carrot and a stick and saying, look, if you want to act like a publisher, fine. Well, you will be a responsible for a publisher unless you agree to keep First Amendment immunities in place, First Amendment protections in place, then we'll allow you to have unique immunity as a big tech platform. And Hawley did like half of that, and the bill ended up being way too complicated. But I still think there's a simple with two sentences, Congress could fix this issue overnight in a way that would not endanger private companies at all, and would at the same time give the best and most protection to free speech.
Okay, got it. That makes a lot of sense. So on the other side of the coin, where am I wrong there? Saying that I'm as free speech absolutist, I understand where Jones was coming from. I assume that was his position, that, hey, I'm just exercising my right to free speech on this platform that's supposedly all about it. That's the contract that we had initially. But to take it to that level, why am I wrong there? Or maybe why am I right there? What am I not seeing?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think what has frighteningly happened, people like Jonathan Haidt and others have documented, is the safe space culture on college campuses really goes back to the kidnapping fears and child abuse fears that were overstated in the 1990s in cases like McMaster's case and other cases and these kidnappings. So what happened was, beginning in the early 90s, you had families not allowing their kids to play out in the street anymore, not going to the park by themselves anymore. Instead, they had play dates and all that kind of thing. And that created a culture where free speech somehow was not, where freedom was dangerous, where right. freedom equaled fear. And that ultimately culminated over the past half decade in the States, United States, of having all these quote-unquote safe spaces on college campuses. My niece goes to Tufts, where everybody thinks it's exactly the same way. And yet they had, I think it was 37 safe spaces on the campus. It's like, safe spaces from whom? They all agree with one another. And so this mentality developed within the millennial culture at places like Twitter and the rest, where they don't believe in free speech at all. And it's terrifying because I agree with you. Free speech to be free must be completely free. I mean, that's why we allowed the Klansmen to say they're going to do horrible.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Even if you hate the person or you hate what they're saying, it's totally disgusting. The bottom line is you still have to stand up for the right to say it.
Exactly. And it goes back to the Jeffersonian principle, which was the best way to answer a bad idea is with a good idea in the public square. Mm-hmm. The best disinfectant of dangerous ideas is to let people be exposed to them and realize, I mean, it doesn't take people long listening to Nazis or Klansmen or other crazy people and say, I don't want anything to do with that. Or Richard Spencer. You know, you don't have the Richard Spencer's erudite and all the rest, but you can listen to him for a little while and then realize, no, I don't think so. So that's the best way, because then people also are confident in their decisions. They don't feel that they're, I remember when I was down in Cuba, what was fascinating is things that are actually that Cuban society has done pretty well. There's a lot of things they have not done well. But there's a few things where they have done well, but the populace doesn't believe it. And they don't believe it because they have been denied access to free and independent information. Mm. Whereas they believe that all of their Cuban family members are all living rich in Miami. They all got Scarface mansions. You know, the idea is like, it's not necessarily going to, dramatically improve your quality of life in the way that they thought it would. And it was a classic example. It was ironic. I was quoting someone who was allied with Castro, and I was like, Castro freely distributed in Cuba his 1957 speech about acquittal. And a large part of that speech is about the importance of free speech in his criminal defense. And it's like, of course, he's already gotten the power. He's like, that's inconvenient. So there's no question that once you even take away anyone's free speech, then you don't have any free speech. And it's only a matter of time before they got everybody's free speech. And that's why, the certain groups I don't represent because I don't like them politically, but if I was the only lawyer that was available to represent them, I would. But that's why I represented people across the political spectrum. Like, none of my clients agree with one another. They would all strongly disagree with one another. But they all should, I want to be the person deciding, because free speech is not only about the person's right to speak, it's about my right to hear and my right to choose what I hear and my right to decide whether what I hear is true or not true, likable or not likable. So when we deny free speech, we're denying the audience's ability to be literate in politics, economics, and social life, to know what all of the different ideas are. It's the same thing as governments trying to suppress literacy in the last century. It's any form of suppression of speech is making people uneducated and uninformed about the topics that matter to their lives. Because there's no better way to get in. Like, just think about it. Years ago, Christopher Lash, great historian, passed away some years ago up at the University of Rochester. He made the point, he forecast a ton of things that were going to happen. He was writing in the 80s, stuff that all came true in the 2000s. But one of the points he made was the reason we engage in debate with people that we disagree with is not necessarily to have them convert us or change our minds, but we become much more educated in the process because we get so agitated. Like, that's not true. We'll go and research it. We'll go and learn about it. We'll go and understand it. We become much better advocates of our own position when we allow them to be contested and challenged like the legal arena does under cross-examination or the equivalent thereof. Yeah. So that's why free speech is critical. It's essential. It's fundamental to any independent thought, any independent society. No free speech, no free mind, no free speech, no free society. And that's why it's fundamental and essential, but it's under wide-scale, broad-scale attack in the United States today.
Yeah, okay, so that's a perfect transition into the next topic. And now what we're dealing with the virus, we'll call it, for YouTube, or Cervasis sickness, whatever you want to call it. I tend to be right in the middle here, where I'm on the side where I do think this is dangerous. I don't think this is the flu. I think there are some health consequences that we don't want to bury our head in the sand. I also don't think that government should come in and make it mandatory for you to stay in your house. I think they should just be honest with you and then allow each individual to make their own decision, or each business to make their own decision. But that out of the way, I'm just really, really concerned moving forward how this is going to set a new precedence for government control and intrusion in our lives, very similar to the way 9/11 did with TSA. So I'd love to get your impression? I'm sure you've been thinking about this quite a bit. Like, number one, what do you think they'll do in the next 3 years, 5 years? How do you think this will play out? And then I guess my next question would be, is it currently legal, or are they going to have to change laws to do these types of things?
So, yeah. So my background on the whole thing was I was one of the more pandemic alarmists when it first started. And it was interesting. It was all people who follow China. That if you follow Chinese politics, Chinese society at all, I had a venture capital friends that were in that category, other people that were in that category. And so once China shut down large parts of its economy and society, that told me this was definitely not just the flu.
Right.
Because no way China's going to do that, because, I mean, you know, the Chinese government wouldn't blink twice at a few folks dying. I mean, what they care about is whether, you know, so-and-so is going to get to the factory tomorrow to make sure this gets done, to make sure it gets to the port. And people were doing satellite photos of port activity, were showing port activity dropping off the cliff.
And traffic, the TomTom report. I don't know if you saw those. Those are great. Yeah.
They are fantastic. It's almost all this comes from independent information, because you could not find this from the institutional press. So as I was going through and looking at it, I was like, all right, this is clearly something severe and serious. We should be prepped and prepared. Trump was sort of dismissive of it early on. And it was fascinating watching all the Western politicians, all of them sensed that the panic from a pandemic could be much more dangerous than the pandemic itself. So that's why even the Italian leftist government, I mean, no matter what political stripe they were, no matter where they were within the political spectrum in the West, for the most part, they all reacted the same at both stages. Both underreacting, saying, don't worry, everything's fine, everything's cool, and the only difference being the left saying, make sure you have parades and hug people who are Chinese and things like that. That was their, you know, make sure there's free travel, and people on the right being concerned with immigration and travel bans. Beyond that, you didn't have much political difference between them and how they handled it. And then they all of a sudden all, in my view, overreact, because in the entire history of the United States responding to viruses, we have never suspended constitutional liberties as part of that process. We have never shut down our entire economy as part of that process. Unemployment actually fell during the Spanish flu epidemics of 1918 and 1919 because they didn't shut down any of the businesses at all. They just imposed social distancing rules and things like that. They shut down mass gatherings, but that was about all. They shut down schools because young people were uniquely vulnerable to the Spanish flu, as in contrast to this one. So my initial view was, I even canceled all my discretionary travel in February. I was like, all right, this is going to get bad at some point. But I never anticipated the overreaction, or that in particular, what we're seeing is politicians using it as a pretext, as a test case, as a template to see how much they can get away with. Because It turns out, you know, like, fear of terrorism could get you somewhere, but couldn't get you nearly as far as they've gone now. Fear of crime in the streets could also get people to forfeit their civil liberties, but nowhere near the scale now. Fear of a foreign enemy could get you scared enough to lock up people of Japanese ancestry in the United States, but couldn't get you to lock up the entire country in the United States. And so it's amazing. It turns out that just whisper the word virus, and you can get people to forfeit all their civil liberties overnight with ease and become eager, to where you have the mayor of L.A. saying, people who snitches don't get stitches, snitches get riches. I mean, that's basically what his pitch was. He's going to give rewards to people to rat out their neighbor. You have people at the World Health Organization saying, we maybe have to come into your house and separate your family for your own good to protect them from one another, from the virus, because it's invisible. I mean, it's the fear factor on this. The only person really in the political space predicting this kind of thing that has any degree of big platform in the United States was Alex Jones, ironically enough. So the guy they're trying to censor and suppress is the one guy who 15 years ago was saying the way they're going to seize power is they're going to use a virus as the guise of it, and they're going to come in and shut us all down and put us under mass house arrest, and we're going to have checkpoint Charlies with military and cops on the streets, and everybody's like, oh, Alex, you're just crazy. But now we're living it. We're living it right here, day to day. Things I never would have imagined. I mean, yesterday they arrested someone for playing T-ball in the backyard with his daughter, and arrested him in front of his daughter for playing T-ball. They were going to arrest and did actually issue citations for an elderly man and for a family holding an engagement party in their own front yard. and issued 7 child endangerment charges against the families for letting their kids be part of an engagement party. They're arresting pastors for holding church services. They're arresting people for doing political protest activities in public. In many cases, they were originally shutting down people's ability to purchase guns. They're shutting down background checks, so people who don't have a gun now can't get one in many parts of the country. They're suspending the Fourth Amendment, both for medical privacy purposes, by disclosing who tested for a virus, putting it on their phone, and letting the government and even the New York Times track them through their phones, track whether...
So they're basically just completely ignoring the Constitution as though it doesn't even exist.
No, exactly. They have quarantined the Constitution.
But how are they able to do that from a legal standpoint? Is there some sort of... I don't know politics, and obviously I don't know law. I don't know constitutional law, but is there some sort of authority they have, like at a time of war, they just say, okay, everything's... Forget all our normal laws. It's something different here while we're at war with Japan or Nazi Germany or something, and they're just enacting that same regulation? Or what am I not seeing here?
It's not constitutional at all. I mean, what I've been explaining to people is it's never happened in the history of the country. In the past, the word quarantine meant you had probable cause that a particular individual had a communicable disease that presented an imminent risk to someone else, and you could quarantine that individual. Not that you could quarantine, do mass house arrest across the board of people you know don't have any disease at all. That's never happened in the history of the country. So, like, and you look at the context of this, there is no war exception to the Bill of Rights. There is no virus exception to the Bill of Rights. There is no national emergency exception to the Bill of Rights. So constitutionally, legally, none of this is justified. And the statutes on the books that are still subject to the Constitution only allow for quarantines in that limited circumstance of an individual you have probable cause has a disease that presents an imminent, clear, and present danger risk to someone else.
If we just test everyone, that, I mean, it solves that pretty easily.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do it. And I think where they're going to ultimately go, one of the frightening things in this is, like, billionaires like Bill Gates have had a very distinct political agenda. And they believe he's one of these, you know, Malthusians that's very big on overpopulation. His father was very big on that. His father's a Planned Parenthood guy. And I always go back to when I was at Yale, we had a debate society where we brought people together. They would have a debate upstairs, and then we would have a dinner afterwards. And we brought professors and students together so they could have discussion. And it was me and 2 other people, one of whom was Justice Breyer's daughter, helped start it and run it. And one of the first groups we had there was someone prominent in Planned Parenthood. And I didn't know much about Planned Parenthood. But I sat down next to him at the dinner as one of the co-sponsoring people in the event. And he's sitting there telling me, he goes, Bob, have you ever looked at where there's overpopulation in the world? And I start to realize this guy just, one, he has a very racist view of what his population theory is. But second, he just assumed I would be with him and on board. They'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right. That is terrifying. What I found terrifying was his ideas. And Bill Gates, if you go back and like watch a 60 Minutes with his wife, where the 60 Minutes guy is saying, isn't it how terrible, how many kids people in Africa have? And I'm like, why is that a terrible thing exactly? And it's just presumed to be the norm. So you have someone like Gates who has long believed that vaccines and poverty reduction in global areas is the key to reducing population. That if people's kids live longer, then they'll have fewer kids. So it's his goal, his obsession, though, has always been overpopulation. He has had massive financial influence on the World Health Organization, on major groups. He's close to both Birx and Fauci. So what makes me nervous is it's like watching the Inferno movie come to life or watching some James Bond villain. It's like when these billionaires have this big power agenda and have extraordinary influence because of their disproportionate wealth, and they're obsessed with some eclectic topic, like particularly tech billionaires tend to get obsessed with. You know, at least Elon Musk thinks that maybe we're in a simulation. That's a very manageable, you know, thing to deal with, right? You're not somebody who thinks we really have to control the population. We need vaccines. And in particular, Gates' thing has been a digital vaccine. So a chip that you could put in somebody to both give them vaccines, but also to trace them for things like a virus. So that in that political context, it's terrifying what's taking place because you have a co-option of the government. And the only reason it's happening or successfully happening is twofold. The legal left, in, well, the, most of the legal class in the United States, most lawyers in the United States, are so overtly political now that the only lawsuits they're bringing, the only lawsuits the ACLU is bringing, the only lawsuits other civil rights lawyers are bringing, is they're bringing suits against Walmart for employing someone because there was a risk of the virus spreading. Or they're bringing suits for inmates to be released from jail early, or bringing suits for immigration detentions to no longer go on.
It's got
or
a bring- different narrative.
Exactly. So it, if it doesn't fit into their narrative, they're not bringing the suit. So they're not bringing any suit on political protest grounds. They're not bringing any, like, for example, I'm about to bring a suit for a guy who just wants to get on the ballot in Virginia. And but he has to circulate petitions because he's an independent candidate. They're refusing to waive the petition signature requirement while also prohibiting from him gathering signatures under the stay-at-home order. So they're basically using it. This is just like the two parties to do so. They're using it to prevent independents from even getting on the ballot any state in the country for the upcoming elections. So I'm going to have to bring suit there, bring suit on behalf of political protesters wanting to do rallies. Rallies, by the way, where they're doing social distancing, where they're 8 feet apart from each other, outdoors, where the virus is much less likely to spread, particularly in some of these places in warm environments, humid environments. And they've been arrested. It's happened twice in North Carolina now. So looking at bringing suit there, looking at bringing suit for the pastors, looking at bringing suit on the Fourth Amendment surveillance grounds for people who are being spied on without their consent, their medical privacy waived without their knowledge. I brought one of the biggest civil rights cases in medical privacy context in the country because Obama was using the IRS to gather people's medical records. And they stole 60 million medical records of 10 million Americans, including prominent judges, actors, movie directors, producers, baseball players. So I brought a big class action suit, got a settlement where that stopped and ended, but I'm going to have to go back to it because they're doing it now again, using the virus as the pretext to do so. And then the other big one is the Fifth Amendment, because we sort of have a balance built in that says if you're going to take away someone's property, someone's occupation, someone's professional license, someone's ability to make a living, then you first have to give them due process so that whatever your legal standard, your evidentiary standard for doing so is actually empirically validated and verified. But also, you have to do you have to give them compensation. No taking without just compensation. And just compensation is fair because it's where we're creating a public risk, but we're making private people bear all the cost and expense of that public benefit. So where there's a public benefit and a public risk, the public should share in that risk. Not, it shouldn't all be borne by the small businesses. It shouldn't all be borne by the little independent worker. And that's where the compensation clause comes in. And all of these politicians are not doing that at all. They're not giving any due process. They're not giving any just compensation. They're relying on questionable data and dubious models that exaggerated the risk, that showed that the remedy was disproportionate to that risk. Essentially, my view is this. Every constitutional liberty should be considered essential services as a matter of law. That no exercise of a constitutional right can never be anything other than essential to America's constitutional republic. Now, the hard part we're going to face is that judges in this political environment don't want to step on their fellow politicians' shoes. And so the ugly history is there's nothing in the documents themselves, the Constitution, the statute, that allow this to take place. What there is a willingness of the courts to turn a blind eye to it. That's how we get decisions like Korematsu. There was no grounds to imprison every person of Japanese ancestry in the United States during World War II. But the Supreme Court said, no problem. And it was one of the most embarrassing, humiliating decisions in the history of our court systems. There's other decisions like that by the courts in the context of quarantines, in the context of national emergencies, where they approved things that simply don't have any basis in constitutional law because the judges themselves are too scared to challenge the governors, challenge the cops, challenge the sheriffs, challenge the mayors, challenge the presidents.
Or the court of public opinion.
Exactly. And we live in an environment where you have two-thirds of people saying they are eager to rat out their friends and neighbors, according to public opinion surveys, that they've been so gripped by the fear. And this is what I found fascinating. Is like I was one of the people saying pay more attention when people were paying no attention. And now I'm one of the people saying you're paying too much attention. You're too scared. You're letting fear obsess you. And you're seeing these classic definitions of irrational mind thought. That, like, in the financial world, you look at that all the time about how fear will grip a market, or how fear will grip a community. Fear will grip consumers. Fear will grip investors. And how that psychology, because as you always talk about, confidence is one of the three keys to any economic system. That's really the psychology of the society or the particular community that's relevant and pertinent to the issue. And we're seeing it in live time. People are saying, whoa, we can't allow 30,000 deaths to occur. We have to crush the economy for 2 years. And it's like, that happens in car accidents every year. I mean, so we're applying logic we've never applied before. We've never shut down our civil society or our economy for on these grounds. And I think another key to it is not only exaggerating the risk, but mitigating the downside. You have a lot of politicians who I think really believe that because of what happened in 2008 and 2009, that the economy will magically restart just like you went back out to the car after you left it in the driveway for a week.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I know that's not going to happen at all. And I've gone through several videos on why the economy is just as sick, if not more sick now than it was back in 2008. One of the thought experiments I used is, if, I don't know if you know this, but Greenspan took rates up to 2005. He took rates from 1% up to 5%. And that's pretty much what triggered all the mortgage-backed securities, because people, their loans readjusted. They couldn't pay the loan, and we know the rest. But if he would have taken rates down, let's say, from 1%, instead of taking them up to 5, taking them down to 0 in 2006, and then let's say we would have started quantitative easing in 2007, would we have had a crisis? And if the answer is no, well, then can you go back and honestly say the economy wasn't sick? Of course it was. We just didn't see the recession because we kept rates artificially low. Same thing here, what we have today, is you can just do another thought experiment, taking rates up to 6%, or the Fed's balance sheet down to, call it $800 billion, if you want to call that normal. And we'd have the exact same economy that we're seeing now with the Cerveza sickness. I know your time is limited here, and I really appreciate it. So a couple more things I want to touch on. First, this is just, in my mind, it's an argument for why the government doesn't need to be in the mix, because people are very afraid of this. And I think if we would have just been honest with them and shown them the facts up front, not only would they be less fearful, but they'd be making more rational decisions, even if those rational decisions were to stay at home, or to wash their hands more, or to wear face masks, and to do all these things that we know actually work well. I don't think that there's a great argument for the government even if this is something that could kill millions of Americans, I still think, left to their own devices with the actual data, that we'd make those same decisions. I hope, at least. So another final question here, and I really appreciate it. How do you think this plays out as far as banning cash? And from a legal standpoint, is there anything in the Constitution that that gives people, Americans, the right to not only use cash, but to have their transactions done in a private manner? If there's not, I'm just curious how that would play out from a legal standpoint.
So two different components there. One is, there is a right to privacy, and that right to privacy extends to financial information. It's most well developed in California, because California has both the state constitutional provision that's analogous to the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, that they've interpreted to be so broad that, for example, in the context of lawsuits, generally people cannot get your financial information unless they meet a very high evidentiary standard. So there's definitely, and then I do a lot of tax cases. I do a lot of like investment fraud recovery cases, which are versions of that, where somebody says, hey, I got a great way for you to protect your assets, a great way for you to mitigate your tax risk. Just give your money to me in this nice foreign location, and the money goes bye-bye. And so help recover it. But in that context, you get into foreign privacy jurisdiction issues all across the globe. You find out which banks in which countries are good and which ones are not so good. You find out which countries where you can give somebody $10,000 and you can find out their entire financial information, versus other countries where they're going to execute you or arrest you on site if you try to even get banking information. So it's fascinating, the practical differences. There's the legal difference, practical reality. So there are privacy rights that protect people's ability to conduct themselves the way they want to financially. This has been challenged on occasion in certain money laundering contexts. But that's why, for example, there's no avoiding taxes is not a money laundering crime. Congress did that deliberately so that the IRS didn't have the power to use the money laundering laws to go to places that they really had no business going in the privacy context. In the currency context, always an open debate. So, like my great-great-grandfathers were all from Rhode Island. They all voted against the original Constitution because it did not yet include a Bill of Rights. So like all the Barneses were like, no, 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 until there's a Bill of Rights, we're not for it. Rhode Island held out, did not approve the original constitutional changes from the Articles of Confederation, in part because Rhode Island planned on printing its own currency, and in part because Rhode Island didn't like the idea of the National Army. Well, of course, once there was a National Army, you know, we all folded once they came in and said we all agree, no problem. So right. There's like the legal theoretical definition of what is the scope of the power of the government to control the means and medium of interchange and exchange. Can they ban Bitcoin? Can they ban cash?
My next question on that, Robert, was can they confiscate gold?
Exactly. We have, unfortunately, the example of FDR. So FDR, after he got elected, I think it was within a year or thereabouts, said, hey, everybody's got to bring their gold back in. And if anybody's caught with gold, bad things are going to happen. So there's always a risk. Now, there was a fair number of people that did not do so. They estimate somewhere like 10 to 15%. And they weren't able to really track him down. And there weren't a lot of high profile arrests because at the time he was doing it, there was serious doubts about whether he could do it. Now, no surprise.
Constitutional standpoint.
Absolutely, constitutionally. Okay. And once again, the courts turned a blind eye because this was the crisis of the Depression. So nobody was going to meaningfully contest because what he was doing was depriving people of their property without just violation of law. So and without any meaningful due process, without showing how was it necessary to take away someone's gold to protect some other compelling public interest. The analysis in constitutional law here in the States is if you're violating someone's core constitutional rights, the government has to show a compelling public interest and that the means they've chosen to protect that compelling public interest is narrowly tailored to it. A lot of what's happening currently in the pandemic is not narrowly tailored remedies. The seizure of gold was not a narrowly tailored remedy. But we live in an environment where the New York governor has suspended laws, has suspended anti-bribery laws, suspended gift giving to politician laws, suspended transparency laws about state contracts, all in the name of the pandemic. It's like, how exactly are the two correlated? Only a politician would think best way to solve this pandemic is we got to get rid of these anti-bribery laws. Then we'll be able to solve it, no problem. So it's that kind of dynamic. So is there a risk of currency seizure or them prohibiting the use of certain things as mediums of exchange? No doubt. Their ability to enforce that constitutionally is still an open question. Their ability to do so practically is probably the bigger question. What I've always advised clients is I say you should have jurisdictional diversification. So right. Like most people look at, you know, diversification of assets in terms of what kind of stocks, whether it's just stocks, so forth. My view is always have multiple assets in multiple places around the world, multiple banks, multiple financial institutions, outside of financial institutions, so that all of the governments around the world have to collapse for you to be screwed, mm-hmm. rather than just one government. I always call it sort of the 15-second plan from the movie Heat, where he says, yeah. You know, don't have anything in your life you can't walk out on in 15 seconds flat if you feel the heat around the corner. Same logic. People should have, it's like, if you were Jewish in 1928 in Berlin, and you see movies and shows like Babylon Berlin, you didn't know what was going to happen just 10 years from now. But it would have been good if you'd had the people that had a Schindler's List plan in advance were able to get out of Dodge before the heat hit them. So
back to probabilities, right?
Exactly. And in our current environment, I've been telling my clients this for years, and most of them had not, you know, taken it seriously or as seriously as I thought they needed to until they've watched this. Because I've been saying, look, the right crisis comes along, politicians are going to use it to see how much power they can seize as fast as they can. And all of a sudden, you're going to regret your ability to not move when you need to move, not to have assets in multiple places where you need. Because, like, what stops them tomorrow from just shutting down bank access? I mean, to give an example, in Vermont, they're saying you can't buy seeds anymore to put to farm in certain places. Mm-hmm. They're putting out there's a proposal to ban all non-essential goods from being sold. so that to ban Target and to ban the big stores from even selling things, to ban those from being sold even online. So once they get to control, once they get to ration goods, what's going to stop them from rationing currency, rationing assets, rationing what you can use as a means of exchange? There isn't. Your only protection then is that, well, you have a born identity plan. So you got a briefcase somewhere in six different countries that you have the means to get to, that if you got to get out of Dodge, you can be fully economically secure where and when you need to be. Anyone who's not doing that right now is taking an undue risk and undue gamble.
I totally agree. Yeah, that's why I always say in my videos, you got to diversify your portfolio, but you got to diversify your political risk and your currency risk. And it's one of the reasons I'm talking to you right now from Medellin, Colombia.
Exactly. Precisely. That you put into action the plan that other people need to start putting into action now, or at least have the plan there so they can execute it if they have to in 15 seconds flat.
Yeah. All right. Wow, Robert. What a fantastic conversation. For any of my viewers or listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where should they go?
So they can on Twitter. I'm still on there right now. We'll see how long that lasts. At Barnes underscore law. They go to the website, Barnes Law, LLP as in Peter.com. And there's also, I've started a little organization that's going to cut, the idea is to replace the ACLU, but be more broad scale and be what the ACLU is supposed to be about, called Free America Law Center. And people can go to www.freeamericalawcenter.com. So any of those places, they can find me and follow and track what we're up to and do it. And it's been fantastic. I think what you're doing with with everything you do on YouTube is fantastic, because it's critical to be self-educated. Also, you do a very good job of making it accessible. God bless Peter and God bless some other folks, but I've been telling them for years, you know, if I use the words fiat currency to the bartender, the eyes start to glaze over. There needs to be something that's accessible that people can, and that's actionable. And you do a great job of making it both accessible and actionable. And it's one of my go-to things. If your video's up, I watch it. It's just because it's like, okay, that gives me information in a quickly distilled way that I can take action on and make recommendations on. So it's, and in this environment, particularly these days politically and with these big tech gatekeepers, it's essential that people like you are there and available for ordinary people.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And on that note, everyone go to georgegammon.com and subscribe to my email list, so we're not at the mercy of these big tech companies and I can communicate with you directly. But Robert, I'll let you go, buddy. I appreciate it. I cannot wait to do it again.
Fantastic. Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.